Greetings and welcome once again to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff. My new nickname is Pelorus Wefferson, named after Pelorus Jack, the legendary bottlenose dolphin from the Marlboro Sound area of the area between the South Island and the North Island called Cook Strait. And he guided boats all through that area for many, many years, even decades. I'm in central Tasmania. It's beautiful. I was very, very lucky to be able to go and have a swim in the ocean yesterday up at the coast north of Launceston. It was my first ocean swim in 3 weeks, and it was absolutely fantastic to have my feet in the sand and stand there in the sunshine and play my flute and drum and bathe my rocks and minerals and crystals in the ocean and swim for about 10 or 15 minutes. It was probably about 14 degrees centigrade. And my family, Teddy, Wally, Ruby Ann, Big Teddy, Heidi, Phil, Huckabara, Ellie, Chickadee, Peter, and Kylie all got to, they didn't get to go swimming, but they were there with me. Oh, Evyups, we had such a beautiful time with the ocean yesterday. And yes, that's what, I could easily live on a shack on the beach somewhere, as long as it was above the high tide line. Anyway, this show, episode number 319, is called Why I Love Music. And I have to preface this by saying that in the same way that my friend who I was riding with yesterday was the only person who was ever determined to tell me all about silence through talking. So in the same way, I have to quote Steve Martin in my effort today to talk about music, is that he said, like, talking about music is like dancing about architecture. So I fully understand it's a completely different mode of communication that does not directly map. You know, you can describe, and this is one of the advantages of symbolic language, is that we can share impressions, and through all the different complexities of psychological this and that it works to a degree. So if we're able to use things with an understanding of the way that they're of benefit, but without becoming victims of the pitfalls of the shortcomings, and then, you know, for what language is good for and what it's not good for. So we must be careful to not confuse the map with the territory. And so I'm definitely not doing that today. And this is not going to be a nonverbal talk radio show, as it should really be. If it's really about music, it would be much sounder, if you will, for me to actually just play my music. And there is my music playing behind us now. And I'm working on a blog post that's going to have links to where you can listen and or download all different kinds of stuff. But just in making the notes for this show just now, I'm just going like, oh my God, talking about music in my life is just about as big. It's almost only one notch down from talking about the importance of oxygen or gravity or sunlight in my life, or food or friendship or my rocks or my whales and dolphins. So music has always been extremely important to me. And so we all know what music is. We go like, it's music by, kind of like by definition, is something that's pleasing and harmonious, and it's acoustic. So you could go like, that was music to my ears. And that could be like, that could have to do with the meaning of something said, or how it actually sounded in terms of bioacoustics. So I'm going to read from an article that I wrote in 1980. This was an article that Dr. John Lilly and his wife Toni asked me to write on their behalf for their organization called the Human/Dolphin Foundation in California in the Bay Area. I moved out there in 1980 or 81 to get involved with their dolphin communication group after I had done a couple of workshops with them at the Esalen Institute. And Toni asked me if I would write an article on their behalf that was going to be for the a special whale and dolphin issue of Magical Blend magazine, which was kind of a new age magazine there in San Francisco. It was pretty new. It only started like the year before. So it was a great honor for me to be asked to write this article. And when I sent it to him, Tony Lilly got back to me and she said, "Jeff, you know, we've had dozens and dozens of people write articles for us, but yours is the very first one that John didn't need to make any corrections on." And so that really blew me away. It was like, you know, this was just after my bout with trying to be a successful college student for a few years, and I used the example. It really set me on my path of true self-education, but showed me what I could do. I'd missed a lot of classes and like my calculus and stuff. I just couldn't bring myself to get up at 8 o'clock in the morning and go and sit there and learn calculus, because it didn't really seem like it was for anything but engineering. Anyway, I had an anthropology course that I missed a month of, but then I asked the professor if I might be able to do a research paper on my own that would be about something relating to cultural anthropology. And he said, "Sure." So I worked on this paper for about a month based on a lot of stuff I was reading at that time. And it was called Sociocultural Variations in the Perception of Time. And he gave me an A+ and wrote a note on there. He said, like, "Did you write this by yourself?" And that, it blew me away, because it was so, I of course I did it by myself. I mean, I used some references that my friend at UNC Chapel Hill had shared with me, some books he had come onto, but I wrote it and read it and did it all myself. And it was like, so when I put my mind to it, I could really do good work. And so to go from that, and 3 years later to be asked by John Lilly and his wife to write an article for them, this was like one of the most leading edge scientists in the whole world, whose communication work with dolphins, you can kind of get a gist of Hollywoodized versions of from two films, a film called Day of the Dolphin and a film called Altered States. Both of these were based on his work. And I've been thinking of talking about the isolation tank a bit with all the ISO hoopla now in the world. But anyway, my angle with the dolphins was using music as a form of communication. And so in this article, I talk about what music is. And so I'll read now. This is in the context of talking about how humans communicate. "The case of music is very special and very interesting. Let's consider instrumental or nonverbal music. Music is sound, vibrations in air, just like speech and noise. But what makes it music? It is sound which is ordered in specific ways. Music has definite patterns of rhythmic, that is temporal variation and repetition, and definite patterns of harmonic, frequency relationship, variation, and repetition. We are speaking of Western music. Eastern music is basically rhythmic and not harmonic, i.e. utilizing chords. Western music is rhythmic and harmonic. Basically, music is combinations of sounds that sound good to us. It is the frequency relationships that determine whether or not we call it music. Western music utilizes any types of rhythms, but a more limited number of frequency relationships or chords. What we call chords are sounds whose frequencies relate to each other in ratios of the reciprocals of small whole numbers." Now that's very, 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 very Pythagorean right there. And I think there's some truth to that. Anyway, but it's still imposing a human-created map onto something that we have to kind of like, the reality itself, we can't quite grasp. Okay, continuing. "What does music communicate? Many things, basically feelings and emotions, which we all experience intensely, but which we know little about. They are very important to us. In fact, they seem to be the essence of life. But why? The concept of resonance is very important. Resonance is a measure of how well two or more systems vibrate together. Two lovers are resonating well. Their bodily rhythms are highly attuned to each other. Musicians playing together are causing their instruments to resonate harmoniously, producing music. If they are playing jazz, then their own bodily rhythms and feelings are being expressed by and through the music, reaching you, the listener, thereby affecting communication. Jazz is very emotional music. Bach is a superb blend of intellect and emotion. Feeling and emotions seem to be connected to resonance. We believe that the same music affects different people in similar ways if they are in a similar state and are open to it. How can this be of use in communicating with dolphins? We know already that dolphins are highly and positively responsive to music, but that's about all. An interesting area for experimentation. We need more research into how our nervous systems perceive and structure sound patterning. Music could be a powerful future tool. So I'll pick back up on the dolphins a bit later. Just a bit of history with music in my life. I think probably the earliest music that I would have heard would be either my mom playing piano, which she was very good, or music in church that where we would sing. And I remember my mom sang in the choir, and they had this certain, not an invocation, but it was some kind of a choral thing that they would do at the end of the service, and it goes, "The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make His face to shine upon you and give you peace, and give you peace. The Lord bless His face to shine upon you." It was quite cool. It was kind of like a medieval sounding, I don't know, it was something I really liked. I always liked it when my mom, when they sang that, because they didn't do it all the time. And my mom's piano, she would play, and she didn't sing, she played piano, but there were, her favorite song was called Autumn Leaves. Autumn Leaves. And I might try to put a version of that on this show here. And I remember some of the earliest records that I used to listen to. There was one of, it was called The Mighty Wurlitzer, this guy playing the pipe organ. And there was this song called Stars Fell on Alabama. And that was really, really cool. It was da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And so anyway, also some of the earliest music that I would have been exposed to would have been on the radio. Oh, my God. And especially when I was really coming of age in the 60s, I remember all too well all the songs that would be on the radio when I was in. I would turn on the AM radio when I first woke up in the morning. This was even in, by the time I was in junior high school, I was doing that. I remember all the stuff that was on the radio, and even, I mean, you know, like, for example, Paul Simon, Me and Julio down by the schoolyard, and, oh, my God, just everything. I mean, Elvis Presley and the Beatles, and then later the 60s came in. I remember hearing Jimi Hendrix on the radio, and, oh, my God, that the music of the 60s was one of the biggest expressions of the consciousness and energy of that whole era. And so, also around when I was in the seventh grade, I would have been 13, I guess. That's when I started learning how to play trumpet. So I got pretty good on trumpet and learned treble clef music. But then after a year or two, because of my lip structure, I was sort of developing an alternative way of playing the trumpet, and I had my mouth kind of partly off of it, and apparently the band and teacher at that time thought it would be an interesting shift for me to learn to play tuba. And so I did. I switched from trumpet to tuba, and I loved it. And I see this as the whole universe preparing me for my future musical creativity, because I learned how to play and express music in both the bass and the treble clef, which was very, very important. And this is just like taking 2 years of Latin, this early musical experience, and then also playing in marching band, has been invaluable preparation for me to be the artist and musician that I am now. So then, and then also, beginning in high school, another part of my musical experience was going to concerts. And so I remember the very first concert I went to was the Rolling Stones Exile on Main Street tour in 1972. I was only 16. I had not even smoked weed yet. I went with my friend Mike Harvey, who was he was the same age as me, but a year ahead in school because he was a bit cognitively precocious. But he smoked some weed sitting next to me, but I didn't smoke any. And saw the Rolling Stones and saw Billy Preston. So anyway, that was the first concert I went to. And then in 1973, I think is when I first smoked weed and started kind of coming out of my science nerd shell and went to some concerts. We went to see Lynyrd Skynyrd and Marshall Tucker and saw Uriah Heep. And, you know, we were in the South. And then over the next few years, I saw a lot of really cool concerts in that area. For example, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Elton John, Yes, several times, Supertramp, several times, The Who, when they still had Keith Moon. I never got to see Pink Floyd or Led Zeppelin, but seeing a lot of cool music. And then around, it would have been the spring of 1978, when I had just sort of begun a new phase of preparing myself. I prepared myself for 2 years and finally began to do some psychedelics. I began by doing some mescaline, and I didn't do it to party. I did it to try to open the doors of creativity, to expand my own consciousness and what I can do with my life. And so around that, I decided I wanted to work equally with words, visuals, and music. So I started painting, and it just started coming out of me. Oh my God. And then I started writing, and I started teaching myself guitar and piano, two instruments I had never had much to do with before. So I bought a Spanish guitar, and I took one lesson from this guy that had studied under Steve Morse, who was the brilliant guitar player for this band called the Dixie Dregs. He had taken, and this guy, I forget his name, but he gave me one lesson. He showed me how to sit and hold the guitar, blah, blah, blah. But that's all I really needed. I needed the one lesson. Then I took off teaching myself, and I'd go wherever a piano was. And my philosophy of learning both guitar and piano was not about sitting down with reading notes and running through scales and exercises and stuff. I started off by trying to just play music that sounded cool to me, no matter how simple it was, but I tried to make it really good, you know, in tune and with good rhythms and stuff like that on both guitar and piano. So that's how I progressed with my whole musical development. So that was 1978. Then around that same time, I was really falling in love with the Dolphins and moved out to California. And that's when after I wrote that article for the Lilies, a few months later, I was invited over to swim with Joe and Rosie, their dolphins that had just arrived from Mississippi. And I was very excited. I mean, this was like, this was the coolest thing that me or anybody else could possibly be involved with at this time. It was the same kind of questing spirit of communicating with extraterrestrial intelligence, with beings that aren't from here. But as John Lilly helped to elucidate more than probably anybody else, that the dolphins are a true extraterrestrial intelligence. And he had even been involved with the SETI astronomers and this thing called Project Osmar. And it was just this whole calling and work involved the same spirit as the sort of a cosmic epiphany, awakening, initiation that I experienced when I was 12 in 1968, that really opened my eyes to the stars and made me want to be an astronomer. And the same energy was coming through the dolphin work with Lily. And so I was there, and I was able to go, and I was at their lab on the day when Joe and Rosie arrived. And then I was able to go back a few months later, and this is one of the coolest things that I've ever been able to do in my life. I was able to play some recorded music through Lily's computer system. It was called the Janus configuration, Joint Analog Numerical Understanding System. And so I'm still not really clear on what they wanted to do. They didn't want to teach them English. They weren't that backward. And they weren't trying to decode or decipher the dolphin communication, which is really an impossible thing to do, but they literally expressed the idea of creating a new kind of communication that would be equal parts dolphin and equal parts human. So it would be empirical, based on whatever would work, but it would still be biased towards the human side, because they're the ones that are holding the dolphins captive. They're the ones with the technology and kind of implicitly calling the shots. But so anyway, I wanted to play the dolphins some music because of how music affected me and how much I loved it. And I was able to play some Pat Metheny, a track called San Lorenzo from their White album, which I consider to be one of their very, very best albums. This is very, very, it was very, some of the most special music that I knew. And also a track called Oceanus, and also part of the track called Visitation from Ralph Towner's Solstice album of 1976. So this was to me the most beautiful cosmic music that I would have played if I was going to be asked to put music on some kind of technology that could go out into space on a space probe like they did with Voyager. I would have put these tracks on there. Anyway, I was able to play this music through the computer system, which mechanically what it did was it took the frequency range that we put in there and it raised it up into the dolphin's hearing range, which is a lot higher than ours. And it also took the sounds that they made and dropped it down into our frequency range. So it was kind of like a physical bridge between the respective frequency domains of the humans and the dolphins. And so I was able to be in the tank with them, swimming around. And I'd been in there for about 5 minutes, and they were just kind of frolicking around, Joe and Rosie, the dolphins. Rosie was bigger, she was the female. And I was touching them some. I wasn't like holding on to them or anything, but they were quite friendly and coming up. And the very first thing Rosie did, I'd been in a bicycle accident a few months before and had just got my leg cast off. And so my knee was kind of skinny and swollen up. And so the very first thing, I'd been in there about 10 seconds when she came over and she took my knee in her beak with her teeth ever so gently and just kind of like beaked my knee as if to ask me if it was okay and to let me know that she could tell that it may not be exactly right. So that was, oh my God, that just blew me away. And so then they put the music on, and this, I will never forget this moment in my life. The instant the music started, I could hear it through my ears in the water. They stopped moving and frolicking and just floated there as if they could feel the music with their whole body. This was the opening bars of San Lorenzo, Pat Metheny song. And just floated there with this most blissful look in their eye as if they were feeling the music with their whole body, and they really loved it. I mean, that was what I felt from them, and for me, oh my God, it was totally transformative for me. Wow, I'm really thinking of this for the first time. What happened in me at that, for those next few minutes while this music was playing, and I was in a small enclosed body of water with these two dolphins, and bound to be the first dolphins that ever heard beautiful human music played at their own frequency range. Wow, this was like a true, I've never really thought of the power of this before, of what it might have done to me, because of, just like I was talking in my last week's show about, that water is kinship, the spirit of kinship, and I was in the water with them, and we were joined by music. And I felt their feelings, and they probably felt mine. This was so powerful, but I realized after a few months that it wasn't cool to keep them captive. And so I embarked on a very, very huge project that was going to involve playing live music with whales and dolphins from more than one location on boats, using the most advanced technology of telecommunications. We would have several musicians on boats in different places, all engaging with whales and dolphins and all engaging them in musical dialogues. And if we could get this all happening at the same time, then we would have links via satellite so that we could hear each other in real time. All the human musicians and all the whales and dolphins could hear what everybody was doing through the use of hydrophones and the high bandwidth real-time connections, and then have a satellite link to one or more radio telescopes that had been set up to function as transmitters, and to beam all this to some undetermined destination in space as a gesture of using our highest technology for something other than warfare. And when I think on this project, it blows me away, and I was putting so much energy into this. I was actually able to meet with the top SETI, Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, people that were, it was then still part of NASA at Ames Research Center, and they put me in touch with Arthur C. Clarke, who I actually talked with on the phone a couple of times, and he was going to be a technical advisor for this. Carl Sagan, when I met him in 1992, he said he would be a technical advisor for this. And I met Pat Metheny and Lyle Mays. They said they would love to participate. I met Ralph Towner in Oregon several times. They said they would participate. And I was lining this thing up. Man, I was figuring out how to turn a radio telescope into a transmitter. And this is before I even knew anything about HARP or anything like that. Apparently, there's people that were already thinking along that kind of line, but not for artistic purposes. But anyway, around early to mid-90s, I really started becoming aware of the grave danger that humans are creating for whales and dolphins and all of life in the ocean. And I made the connection in my mind of, look, how could it be possible for us to have a truly fruitful musical dialogues with whales and dolphins while we're waging war on them? And so I've dedicated almost all of my major life energy and activism and creativity towards their behalf in this time, to try to understand who they are as fellow beings and what the real problems are that we're creating. So this has been my most adventurous connection and use of music so far. So then, back to the story. I first did my first recording. Like, I've never claimed to be, I'm not a virtuoso in terms of technical ability on any instrument. I was first chair trumpet, I was first chair tuba, but it wasn't about for me to be a virtuoso level technical person. I was about the music, about hearing music that I love and listening. And I've often said that music is like oxygen to me, but if I ever had to make a choice between, if I could only either play music or listen to music, it would definitely be listen. Because, you know, I could get by, I mean, there's enough people that have played and recorded so much beautiful music. And that's another thing I haven't even talked about, the whole aspect of recording. Like, what was music like? Music before the days of recording, before the phonograph and the reel-to-reel deck and then the digital recording and stuff and transmission, music before the electronic era was live. I mean, that's a big, 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 big thing to get our head around. Music was only experienced live when you were in the presence of someone playing it for you, or like a concert, or you know, and this was why the symphonies and the orchestras of back in the day, this was like one of the main cultural events and achievements. And, you know, people would have, the wealthy nobility would have, they would have their composers, their performers, they would have their Leonardo da Vinci's designing art, and hopefully not too many weapon systems and stuff like that. But so that's one of the greatest technological gifts to me that we've got, a benefit from the electronic revolution, is the ability to record music. And I've read that back in the days of ancient Greece, that was one of the abilities of the gods. The gods had the ability to record music. So this is something very interesting to listen to. The Greeks also wrote about how the dolphins loved music, especially the flute and the lyre, probably maybe because of the frequency range, they could hear it better, but they were also enchanted by singing in harmony, which I can fully understand because it kind of does that to me too. So anyway, I embarked on doing some recordings, just for my own use, but on nice grand pianos. And so in I think in 1984, I went in a studio in Charlotte, North Carolina, called Reflections, and recorded a grand piano improvisation there. And then in 1985, I embarked on my very first multi-track recordings with this dude named Rick Chapman in Atlanta. And this is where he had a really half-inch, 8-track, really good studio at his house. And I did him a really nice painting. And I recorded my first techno rap songs, Threshold, Infotoxin, and Einstein's Brain. These were songs to a drum beat that had guitar and synthesizer, but it was mainly me talking, poems. These were kind of protest songs. Infotoxin was about the psychology of mass media and mediocrity and pop culture and the marketing character and all that stuff. It was the birth of a concept. It was meant to be a piss take, but then I was able to develop the concept into serious concept that was published by two different magazines in Canada, including Adbusters. And then these songs got a lot of airplay on WUGA in Athens and about a dozen other college radio stations around the country. That was really cool. And then I actually played keyboards with the founding members of this band called Widespread Panic, John Bell, Mike Hauser, and Dave Schools. They came over to my house one day in Athens because they had heard Infotoxin and Einstein Spray. They had heard it on the radio, and they go like, look, Jeff, we want you to be in our band because we need a keyboard player. And so they didn't have a drummer either, so we used Cliff Devereaux. He was a drummer that modeled himself after Neil Peart of Rush. He and I had already done a recording, which I really, really, really wish I still had a copy of. It was called View from the Brink. And it was me and him just went in the studio in Atlanta and jammed for an hour. I was playing piano and he played drums. And we just jammed and I read this poem called View from the Brink. And it was, oh my God, it was so cool. Got to find a copy of that somewhere. So then I did all kinds of music gigs in Athens. Went out to Santa Fe, New Mexico. Moved to Boulder, Colorado. Did some gigs there where I would pull together people. Like one of the coolest things we did, I had a friend called Steve Sorotkin and did a bunch of stuff at his studio, including Trilobite and Return of the Lorax. A lot of experimental stuff. We did a live jam at a place called Quigley's, which was like a cafe on the CU campus, where we showed the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey, and then we just jammed. And so I've got bits and pieces of that, but that was really cool. Then in 1996, I went to a place called the Light Center, which is kind of a geodesic dome meditation place up near Black Mountain, near Asheville, North Carolina, and did a solo piano recording, which I've got a DAT recording of that now. Then, thanks to my friends Frank and Nancy Pascoe, who liked my piano playing, they loaned me $1,000, and in 1998, I made a trip from Portland, Oregon, down into the Four Corners area in Arizona, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, and went there for a couple of weeks to gather energy for my first serious recording that I then went back to Portland, Oregon, and did it on what I considered to be, at that time, the day of the cosmic link between Earth and Sirius. It was July 28th, which I now know that's more of a window of time rather than a day, but it was the thought that counted. And I came back and went in a studio called White Horse Studio in Portland and recorded 9 grand piano improvisations with the engineer Dave Friedlander doing effects in real time based on things in nature. Like, all I had written down was the topics like on the brink, trees, water, the key of rocks, tornadoes, stars, and the insignificance of humanity. So I did that and actually paid a couple of $1,000 to have 1,000 CDs made and gave away a lot. And it was right at that time that I came down under, brought a bunch of those CDs with me. The very last recording I did in the States was in December. It was on the full moon that happened to fall right on the winter equinox in 1999. It was called the Proxygian solstice session, because it was also, not only was it the full moon right on the equinox, it was also the moon happened to be as close as it ever gets to the Earth. All of these lined up on the same day, which only happens once every few hundred years. And I got Zach Velmer, who was a really cool drummer from Sound Tribe Sector 9. He came and played drums, so we jammed and did that. That turned out really cool. And another connection I had with music was a lot of the sort of well-known musicians who I had managed to run into and rub shoulders with. And on the top of the list was Sarah McLachlan, the legendary Canadian singer who did, at the time I left America, and I believe playing in the radio on the car when my mom and dad dropped me off to hitchhike back to Asheville. This would have been December of 1999. I think this was the very last time I saw them. That song was playing, In the Arms of the Angel, and I told them how I had met Sarah McLachlan. Oh my God, when she kissed me, it put a spell of enchantment on my whole life. So anyway, came down under, started meeting some really cool musicians in New Zealand, met in 2002, I met Ian McAllister, who is one of my best friends now, the music wizard. He's in Christchurch, he records in New Zealand Symphony, and specializes in acoustic music, and he's just been able to get back in his studio this past week, but we do stuff together every year. He's just an amazing person to work with, and did a recording there with Redford Grinnell, who is the drummer from Shapeshifter, and Carmel Courtney, a very talented saxophone player and vocalist. The three of us did a jam at Duke Dixon's place in Oxford near Christchurch. He has a 100-year-old 9-foot Steinway, and that I turned into the first Ancestor CD, which is pretty damn cool. And Ian and I worked on that doing the mixdown for like a month. Then I did some recordings with Takumi Motokawa, a very talented young Japanese virtuoso piano player. Then I did a jam in Takaka, New Zealand, thanks to my friend Grant Knowles, called the Takaka Equinox Piano Anomaly Impressions. And this was quite cool. Around that time, I met Harry Williamson in Melbourne, did some stuff with him, including playing his angel guitar that he built. Then, in 2005, I actually bought a pretty nice acoustic steel string guitar that I had both two different luthiers to work on it, and got that in really cool shape, and it's still my guitar that I have now. It's actually at Ian's studio. And around this time, I started meeting some people that were didgeridoo players, like when I was up in Darwin. So I started connecting with that kind of music, which was cool. Then my partner, Elizabeth Verstraten, was inspired to get an Odell Borg Native American flute in the key of F sharp. So she and I would play. We would jam on guitar, and then on Flinders Island in 2011, I was inspired to create a tuning for my guitar based on her flute. And it's a modified F-sharp tuning, but it is so cool. It's the tuning I use today. And that was just that, the spirit and energy that came through that was just a total gift of the universe. And so when she and I jammed and played a lot and got pretty good. And then we split up, and then I got my own flute just like hers in 2013. So I've been teaching myself Native American flute for, I guess, 7 years now. And in 2006, I got a computer for the first time in 2005, and so I did a recording in Wellington. I've recorded many, many, many times with many, many, many people in many, many, many studios with a lot of really good musicians. Did a session in Wellington with this drummer named Glenn Fletcher, who was pretty cool, a bit psycho, but a good drummer. And the guy the engineer there gave me this program called Cubase. It was the original version of Cubase, and I put that on my computer. So when I spent 6 months in Chile in 2006, when it was all rainy and stuff, I'd sit there on my computer all day long doing these really cool, elaborate multi-track experiments, where I would take like I created a track called man was in the forest. I took the only dialogue from the film Bambi was when Bambi's mother said, this was in response to the forest fire that drove all the animals away. She said, man was in the forest. So I put that in there, and then the rest of it's got Didge going backwards. It's got sounds from Fiorella Terenzi, the sounds that she created from the radio signals of two galaxies colliding with each other, all different kind of weird, freaky stuff. And I took the opening sound, the thing from The Outer Limits, and put that backwards. And I'm just going crazy with all kind of stuff. So, and then in 2009, Lisbon and I sat down in the basement of our friend in Tasmania and started making our first film called Cryo 2008, Create Your Own Reality. So it was a look back at what we did in 2008, and it was a really cool film. And I created the soundtrack to that based on stuff I'd already recorded. So we went on to make five films, or really four films and a trailer. And three of those had music that I recorded myself. One of them was a slideshow based on the beauty of Antio, Great Barrier Island. And for it, we used many, many, many different tracks from many various musicians. So quite a few of whom we communicated with and sent them painted rocks, and they gave us permission. Like, for example, Scott August and R. Carlos Nakai, among others. So that brings me to now, where I continue to play my flute every day. And also, in 2014, on the Big Island, a really cool woman named Elizabeth Thuria made a Native American frame drum for me with the head made from the skin of golden buffalo. She just had one piece left, and she has Native American ancestry herself. So this was extraordinarily powerful. And so I started playing that drum. And it was this drum that I was playing on top of Mauna Kea in late April of 2018. At the exact, oh my God, this was another really freaky synchronicity. When the head of the drum broke right at the instant of sunset, and then a couple of days later is when all hell started breaking loose with the bottom dropping out of these calderas and that big eruption started. So my flute, I've given Maori names to. I spontaneously named my flute, and then I learned that flute players do that. My flute is called Aihi Waniwa Tui Ruru Kotari Kaitiaki Magellanic Thunder Song, which is mainly Maori names for birds. The Magellanic clouds are the closest galaxies that we can see. Thunder Song. Aihi is dolphin, Aniwaniwa is rainbow, and so I try to play my flute to rainbows whenever I see one, just like I saw one 2 days ago here at sunset. It was very beautiful. Then my drum is called Io Paikia Sun Thunder Kaka Tatanka Good Medicine Maokea Pele Maokea Wave Dancer. So Io is the Hawaiian deity, the big, it's like the Jehovah or the Yahweh of the Polynesians. Paikia is their name for the white whale. Sun Thunder Kaka is the beautiful parrot, the quite vocal parrot of New Zealand. Tatanka, the Lakota name for the Great Spirit. So this is my flute and my drum. I think I made up a name for my guitar at one point, but I can't remember what it was. But it's got seven stars on it. It's the only time I ever used oil paint when I painted the body. It's got seven stars, maybe in honor of the Pleiades, or the seven sisters, Mata Riki, who are now beginning to become visible in the mid-evening sky. Anyway, that's probably enough talking about music, but I love music. I love to listen to all kinds of beautiful music. I listen to my own stuff a lot lately, you know, to kind of study what it is I've done. And when I listen to multi-track experiments and then hear, like right now I'm trying to work with Ian to do some long-distance stuff. I just did a track a few months ago that was the very first time that I played electric guitar along with my flute. And thanks to what Ian did, I also was able to use a violin bow and bowed the guitar strings in the open tuning of that modified F sharp. And then Ian did some effects on that, and it sounds really, really, really cool. But there's so much really cool music to listen to. There's a show called Music from the Hearts of Space that I highly recommend. Just this past week, I was tuning into the work of this brilliant British musician named Mike Oldfield, who did a thing called Tubular Bells back in the early 70s. Well, he actually did it in the 60s because they used it as the soundtrack to The Exorcist. But that music was created before the film, and he let them use it. So, but his concerts, Millennium Bell and Tubular Bells Live, are some of the coolest live performances I've ever seen. He's got maybe several dozen, maybe 50 or 60 musicians, string players, percussionists, keyboard players, vocalists, all on stage at once, doing this cool sort of hour-long sets of going from song to song. And he's got the tubular bells, these big sort of percussive cylindrical instruments hanging up there, and he plays guitar. Very, very, very musical family. His sister Sally, the beautiful voice, her album Waterbearer. He's a very classic, kind of like neo-Celtic, folk rock, Lord of the Rings kind of enchanting music. And his brother Terry Oldfield, who's actually my friend on Facebook. But anyway, I'm trying to get in touch with a woman who has, she has a baby grand piano in a room here where I am, be able to play that. And looking forward to getting back in Ian's studio. And one of my goals, when I do hope to return to the continental U.S. one of these days, and a friend of mine is now living at this place in Arizona called Arco Santi. It was this kind of community designed by a vanguard architect named Paulo Soleri. And I didn't know that much about it, but my friend Cameron has sent me some photos of this place. And he said, actually, the central reason that this place was designed for its acoustics, and it's got all kind of amazing acoustics and sound systems and instruments, grand pianos, and he said a lot of bands have come there to record and people do concerts. And so I've set it as a goal of mine to do a live music session there and recording somehow, and see what musicians I can invite to come and join us, and how I might be able to persuade them to let me do it. Anyway, also, there's another musician that's done some really cool stuff. His name was Paul Horn, H-O-R-N. He took his flute, his metal concert flute, and recorded, like, inside the Taj Mahal, inside the Great Pyramid, inside the Grand Canyon, inside various cathedrals and stuff. And I also find that sometimes the stairwell and parking decks have really interesting acoustics. Anyway, I better shut up for now. This is Jeff Phillips Wefferson signing off. Order yourself a flute from Odell Borg. That's highspirits.com. He makes brilliant, brilliant flutes in Arizona. They're traditional Native American designs. If you get on his newsletter, he's got a flute of the month on half price every month. So music is the language of the soul. It's like oxygen to me. And please check out my blog post. Feel free to listen and download any or all of my music. And please, if you're a musician yourself, I'd love to hear what you do. All right, this is Jeff Phillips signing off. Good day.
Thank you.